was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
Your investment in Community Radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032. Or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final, discussion with Eric Ward and Scott Nakagawa on Thursday, March 4th from 6 to 8 p.m. This Zoom conversation is hosted by the Multnomah County Library. You can sign up for the event at the Multnomah County Library website under the events calendar for Thursday, March 4th. Scott Nakagawa and Eric Ward were interviewed for It Did Happen Here, the podcast about fighting neo-Nazis in Portland in the late 80s and early 90s. They'll talk about the work they did with the Coalition for Human Dignity and where the fight against white nationalists stands today. Again, that's It Did Happen Here, Nothing is Final. Registration happens on the Multnomah County Library website on their events calendar for Thursday, March 4th. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than right now, and KBOO needs your help. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give or kboo.fm/donate. There's also a donate button on the website, and there's even an app. Of course, there's an app. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. We know people are facing financial hardships, but every little bit helps. So donate whatever you can for the radio station you know and love online at kboo.fm/give and help keep us on the air. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. As a latecomer to this region, I thank the Indigenous peoples of the Portland area for their stewardship of this land. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molalla, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others, and KBOO thanks them. I do have a guest this month, but first I'm going to read a couple of poems by poet and playwright Kathy Tagnak Rexford. Kathy Rexford was born in Alaska and is of Inupiaq descent. She earned an MFA from the University of British Columbia. Grounded in photography and lyric documentary, her poetry has appeared in various anthologies. Her chapbook, Black Ice, appeared in Effigies, an anthology of new and indigenous writing, Pacific Rim, and individual poems have appeared in Ahani, Indigenous American Poetry, and Two Topos Poetry International. Her plays include The Namesake, and with Challen Wilson, The Winter Overture. Rexford also works on short films. She's received fellowships from the First Peoples House of Learning and the Rasmussen Foundation. I'm going to read two poems by Kathy Tagnack Rexford. The first is titled Baleen Scrimshaw as 16mm Film. Shoot in 16mm film. Capture her sitting under an olive green archway. Loop the sound of steel striking glass. When you blink, the camera captures the frame of her kin walking upside down. Loop the sound of tundra grass sprouting. Her hairline marks her shift from caribou to woman. Standing in front of three white spotlights, the silhouette of five black arrowheads departs from her lips. Splice together her eyelashes and frozen lids. Exaggerate the strain of her freckles coiled into song. Inukshuks tumble from the tips of her fingernails, guiding the landing strip for twin otters. They watch their children travel to the moon, or perhaps they erase our oiled webs. Chart 16 luminaries into the Beaufort Sea. Wait, wait, wait. The shutter will remember their white-crested etchings. They resurface in the lyric of your documentary. That was Baleen Scrimshaw as 16mm Film by Kathy Tagnack Rexford. Second poem I'm going to read by her is The Ecology of Subsistence. No daylight for 2 months. An ice chisel slivers frozen lake water refracting blue cinders. By light of an oil lamp, a child learns to savor marrow. Cracked caribou bones a heap on the floor. A sinew thickly wrapped in soot threads through the meat on her chin, a tattoo in three slender lines. One white ptarmigan plume fastened to the lip of a birchwood basket. Thaw approaches, the plume turns brown. On the edge of the open lead, a togglehead harpoon waits to launch. Bowhead sings to krill. Thickened pack ice cracking, a baleen fishing line pulls taut a silver dorsal fin of a round white fish. A slate blade knife slices along the grain of a caribou hindquarter. The ice cellar lined in willow branches is empty. Salt water suffuses into a flint quarry. Offshore, a thin layer of radiation glazes leathered walrus skin. Alongside shatters of a hummock, a marsh marigold flattens under three black toes of a sandhill crane. A translucent sheep horn dipper skims a freshwater stream. Underneath Arctic char lay eggs of mercury. Picked before the fall migration, cloudberries drench in whale oil, ferment in a sealskin poke. A tundra swan nests inside a rusted steel drum. She abandons her newborns, hatched a deep crimson. And that was The Ecology of Subsistence by Kathy Tagnack Rexford. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest this month is Naima Lightseed. Naima Lightseed uses the pronouns she and her. She's a poet and priestess of the new paradigm, dedicated to inviting personal and collective transformation through embodiment, education, language, art, and ritual. An artist since childhood, she has a BFA in theater performance from Roosevelt University and has been a healing professional since 2004 with certificates in Hatha Yoga teaching from the Temple of Kriya Yoga and massage therapy from the East-West College of the Healing Arts. She writes and performs medicinal poetry, offers therapeutic bodywork and creativity coaching, teaches about the role of somatic awareness in the liberation process, creates community ceremonies, explores the relationship between gravity and social justice, and seeks the marrow of life through a variety of meditative and creative disciplines. As a fat Black woman navigating the intersection of multiple forms of oppression, while determinedly seeking the joy that is our true nature and living as art. She strives to create safer spaces where the oppressive structures we have inherited can be transmuted, and the work of seeing, accepting, and celebrating the fullness of human experience is possible. Welcome, Naima.
Thank you, Teal. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'd like to invite you to read some poetry.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I'll start with one that it's one of my older pieces. It's on my album, Prism, and it's one of the first experiences I had of poetry where I felt like the poem was coming through me rather than I had this idea and now I'm going to record this idea. It felt like it was a grace moving through me, and then I edited it and refined it, and it has refined itself over the years a bit, but it still has this feeling to me of more like catching a wave or gathering light through a prism specifically, or holding a bird in your hand than some mechanically created thing. So it's called Love Let Her.
You are a poem, a composition, an exposition of the revelry, a piece of the mystery revealed in each flick of hair, in each turn of phrase. Just as no sun can reach every leaf on the tree, so can no one illumine all your crevices and curves. But each question brings me closer to the truth I see in you, I feel in you. It whispers out in your extrapolate as we penetrate the darkness with our voices. The places where we meet become event horizons. Divinity means sees no division. This life, a revision of our history, our pedagogy, our hierarchy. I ask, and you only say, more colors, please. You are a poem, born anew every time I turn the page, take the stage, say yes to the mystery and not the assumption, with just enough gumption to know when to say nope. We'll play more when we're ready. This heady presumption of falling into love is nothing compared to the constant discombobulation of a life lived in exploration. This theory, this question, this veil lifting exercise. Now that we are learning who we are and who is with us, and what it is that the world needs of us, what will we do with our power? Let me be your composition. Tear down each of my constructs. Let each of my limits be a word in no particular order. Each of my glances a clue. Each of my prayers a step closer to the mystery of you. You, 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 you. You are the poem. A play of form and spiral and shadow and color and rage and joy. And triumphant light, born anew every time I listen to you, demanding that I pay attention, because we only get to hear you once in this magic now. You say we are just flowers unfolding, and I wonder, how do I reach your stamen without corrupting the petals? I am no bee.
I want all of it, all the life, all at once, to dissolve in your ocean, to be so overwhelmed by a single ecstatic breath of your atmosphere that I lose all illusion of separation and become a million stars in your sky.
Yeah, so in introducing that poem, you said that it was your first experience of poetry really coming through you as opposed to something that, you know, an idea that you had that you worked out. And many poets do experience poetry as something that comes through them. But you also said that you had gone back and edited and polished the poem. And for many poets, they're kind of resistant to that editing or polishing when they have that experience with a poem, where there's a tension between the idea of poetry as something that you're just a vessel and the editing process. So could you speak to that in your own process?
Thank you for that question. That's such a great inquiry. And my sense is there's space for both. When I'm writing a poem, what usually happens is I'll have an initial impulse, or either it'll feel like channeling, like I said at the beginning, like I'm catching a wave that's just coming through me and I put out a net and gather what I can. But sometimes I'll be processing some emotional experience, something painful or joyful. I'll be witnessing something that I'm seeing in nature or in my loved ones, and I will capture that as quickly as I can. I tend to write out my poems long form, handwritten in a journal first. And I try not in that first bringing through to edit too much. I might replace a word as I'm moving through if something strikes me, or in the process of recording it that first time, there might be some revisions that happen at the same time. But generally, it'll be a very, I'm just putting the words on the page kind of experience. And then later, sometimes a few hours, sometimes a few years, I'll go back and usually type up the poem on my computer. And in that process of transcribing, I'll be using a little bit more of the editor brain and still striving to serve the quality of energy that was moving through me when I first channeled the poem in an attempt to convey the experience as clearly and as crystallized as I can. So I'm not just adding poetic devices because I want to make it more interesting, but I do want to look for places where rhythm, rhyme, alliteration, assonance, imagery, metaphor, where I could add those, because the power that they hold, there's a reason they've been such a part of our experience as writers for so long, because they do, I think, tap into the subconscious in a particular way. And like, the English is this beautiful language that's also deeply flawed. You know, it's based on colonization and war. And so there are some experiences that I'm coming to understand are actually, they do have words for them in a lot of indigenous languages, but we have to kind of speak towards them or around them. And this is where poetry comes in, because we can say in such fewer words, or we can point towards something true in such fewer words than we could ever use trying to explain it with words that we don't have. And so that's what I'm going for in the editing process, is not trying to turn the poem into something cold or mechanical, but using the tools that we do have to crystallize and bring into greater clarity the ideas and the story and the interesting and compelling for the people who experience it.
Great. Okay, so let's hear a couple more poems and then I have some more questions for you.
Great. I'm going to share a couple newer ones now. Yeah, this one's a shorter one that I find it's really up for me right now, because we are in this transition of power, we could say, and watching, I actually wrote this right around the election, and just watching the posturing and sadness, or what caused me to feel sadness of, you know, the so-called leaders of this country. So it's called Return.
One does not, by words alone, make oneself a king. Leaders are not born of boasting. Rulers rise not from crushing their own still beating, not burning that which awakens the still wild. We are wary and weary of braggarts, false prophets, self-appointed messiahs, those who clamor loudest, tend to the least, and say even less. Proclaim their greatness to hide weakness, at best cowards wearing skins they tricked and sickened off lions, at worst bullies devoured from within, consuming until the end to feed a hunger never seen. How with silk and stealth they punish the world for their own bitter stunt. My monarch, a butterfly, one who has peered at what lives inside, melted in astonishment, anguish, exultation. Let death take them, let life remake them, given their fire, a wise purpose, been reborn times beyond measure, remembered what it is to remember. Knows only our inner authority is true, is learning how to turn swords into shovels, to compost the words and weapons of war, that the field within and all around is not of battle, but potential. In the world where we fly, where myceliarchy reweaves us, leaders are chosen, earn their power through uplifting others. Give us grandmothers for president, tall trees for kings, rivers for advisors, an honest gardener for prime minister, replanting the forest for the first executive order. As the reawoken roots reach for each other.
And I can go into another one. This is called Salt, and I actually wrote this in the last vacation that I took. Tuning into that construct that capitalism imposes upon us, that we have to be working all the time to have any worth in the world. And it was really like, I just want to enjoy the fact that I am on a beach right now, and had a hard time with it. So I wrote this poem to support that. It's called Salt.
Picture me dancing along the wild edge where land meets sea. Belly and thighs bare, salt in windswept hair, sand under bare feet, pressing soft tracks along the warm ocean. When you think of me, this strong black woman, it would be easy to envision toil, my endless struggle, how hard I must work. As black women have long been measured by what we can produce and by what against we are forced to fight. Do not lend your voice to the chorus that would clamor, rest is indulgence and fun is only for the lazy. Disagree with the hordes saying we must work ourselves to exhaustion. Capitalism was built on our brown backs. Do not beat us with that whip again. Question that which would ask if I deserve, if we deserve such relaxation, and why we believe we must earn feeling well. I have spent too many years believing myself worthless in this skin, too many hours never accomplishing enough. My grandmothers did not sing me into being to work myself to death for them or for you, and especially not for the system that tried to eat them. No single nap could touch the tiredness settled into these bones. Play must be my path now, pleasure my guide, and art our tool to chisel the new paradigm into being through our joy. Strong is a word we have earned. and also brave. But now, let it be brave, too, to put down shovel and pick up snorkel, or paintbrush or pen, to trade for a moment a sword for a swimsuit. When you think of me, do not envision me working, though that will come in myriad essential ways, not struggling, please. Never that again. Not distressedly shaking my fist at a concrete sky. Picture my unbound thighs jiggling as I play in the foam, my unfettered hair swept by trade winds, my copper-brown skin shimmering as I twirl and bend, as I dance my gratitude for this body's place in the symphony of sun, sea, and sand. The taste of salt and freedom, and a soft smile on my lips as I gaze into the beyond.
Wow. Well, that is a very powerful and particularly poignant poem at this time when many of us haven't been able to travel, you know, because of the pandemic and because it's not safe to travel worldwide. That's a really very sensual poem. And poetry can often seem like a really cerebral activity. I mean, you're sitting there and all that's moving is your hand. And in your bio, you spoke about collective transformation through embodiment. So I wonder if you can talk about embodiment and what that means to you and how it plays out in your poetry, which we just heard an example of. And then if you could go on and talk a little bit about the challenges of realizing embodiment in art under these conditions where we're having very little personal contact.
Oh, you know, what comes to say first is pain. And some of the poems have come as a response to letting myself feel what's really going on and the invitation to, you know, numb out or ignore or try to fix, be in touch with the subtle nuances of what my body is trying to communicate with me. And that sensitivity, like I remember, you know, when I was younger, friends saying, oh, you're too sensitive, oh, you're too sensitive. But I feel like that sensitivity is one of my greatest gifts in enabling me to feel and notice what's actually happening in myself and in the world around me. And so the deep listening into what's actually happening inside of our bodies, I really feel like is essential to our healing and our well-being. And the more I learn about trauma and about the relationship between colonialism and enslavement and our physical bodies and our response to trauma, the more I understand that it really is, for most people, I think at some point, an essential part of the healing journey. And not that it's always accessible for everyone. I want to honor that that is also true, and not try to say that there's one right way to heal by any means, but that there is I've come to understand that everything we experience through the body. You know, our minds give us information and they filter things and they categorize things, but it's the body that actually sees, you know, with our eyes or smells or feels the pain of the injury or feels the pleasure. And disconnection from our bodies is actually how we end up with a lifetime of disconnection in so many other ways. And a few years ago, I heard someone say that, you know, disembodiment is a key tool of colonialism. And just from so much of what I know about, you know, what happens when empire has, you know, gone to places to enslave people or steal land or in some way, you know, take over, they usually make it so that people aren't allowed to do their dances and their traditional songs and, you know, ritual practices, which were often very much based in the movement, in the body, in the relationship between the body and the earth. So I feel like so much of that reclaiming of our legacy and our selfhood, our sovereignty, comes from exploring this internal integration between this not truly separate, this kind of Cartesian understanding that the body is one thing and the mind is one thing and the spirit is one thing, if spirit is even a thing, kind of really coming to more of this holistic understanding of their different manifestations of the same being. And the more we can heal those internal connections, I feel like the more honest we can be with ourselves, the more effective we can be as creators, and the more less likely we are, that the harder it gets to control us when we're actually listening to the deep yes and deep no inside of our bodies. And then to respond to the second part of your inquiry, it is a question that I am still inside of myself, as having been someone who's, so many of my experiences have been, you know, in groups, in the room with the people, learning how to invite that same kind of connection to individuals, you know, within their own bodies and amongst groups across a screen is a practice for sure. But I would say that there's always, you know, embodiment is about being how we are, where we are, when we are. And so even sitting on one's couch, having to interact with the computer, there's still an invitation and a capacity to notice your feet and your hips and your legs on whatever's supporting you, your floor and your walls and the immediate environment. And if someone does have access to nature, even a small tree in a backyard or a nearby park, the earth and the more than human people are there and are often available to be connected with to support that interaction, even if it's as simple as, you know, putting a hand on a tree bark and feeling that living being and the texture of the bark. And then I would say, especially for people who are isolated right now more than others, what are the ways that you can explore pleasure that are accessible and maybe would not have been what you would have done a couple years ago when you could more easily congregate with people, but can you get really into the texture and smell of herbs when you're making a tea, or the quality of the lotion or oil when you moisturize your skin, or maybe can you put a little bit more time and attention into the meals that you prepare for yourself and how it feels to hold the vegetables or the grains and the sound of the water cooking on the stove, and these sensory phenomena that tap us into the present moment and our own bodies. And then as you're noticing that, the smell of the warm steam from the tea, or the feeling of your clothing, the texture of your clothing as you're getting dressed in the morning, these tactile sensations, can you also let that be a doorway back into your own physical and emotional experience and notice, how do I feel when I smell this tea? What emotions are present as I'm bringing this fabric onto my body? So it's, while we are social beings, and I do feel that there's going to be some healing and repair on the other side of this when we're able to be together in person again to kind of help us heal the wounds of isolation and returning to community and connection, there's also a possibility of finding in each moment, wherever we are, doorways into that greater awareness of the moment and our bodies, step by step, moment by moment, with the seemingly simple things we do every day. What am I doing right now? What feelings does that activate inside me? Can I notice? Can I breathe? Can I listen? Can I be here?
That's great. I think those are really important things to hear in this time when a lot of us maybe are feeling disconnected and disembodied. This is Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and my guest this month is Naima Lightseed. Would you like to read a couple more poems for us?
I would love to. So this next poem I call Teacher, and it came as a response to some questions I received about, you know, how do you write the poems that you write, or some invitations to teach writing poetry. And I feel like it encapsulates so much more than I could explain what is the essence of poetry writing. When the time is right, I shall teach about writing poetry. But when I bother to weave the words to impart this art, it will not be just through the conventions of form. Any fool can pick up an old tome and learn the tools that make this language roll off the tongue. Rhythm and rhyme, alliteration and metaphor may be dying devices, but enough people know of their power to keep them out of the grave. No. When I strive to leave a legacy of fisher people, not just those who have been given fish, it will be by imploring them to see everything, to look at the marrow of life as a scientist studies cells. I will charge them to feel everything, to have their hearts broken until there is only heart dust left, like the sparkling debris of exploded stars, and let the flour of their shattered hearts be kneaded by the great baker into the bread they will use to feed their readers. I will invite my little poetlings to give away their most precious belongings, travel to a place where they do not speak the language, and listen to all the ways people convey love in words they do not understand. I will remind them that they are not, can never be, in charge of their gifts. They cannot demand that words come, though they can pray. I'll warn them that if they choose the path of the poet, if they dare to look at their own geniuses, they may find themselves on their knees, calling for the muse to return or leave them alone in season. Actually, I probably won't tell them that last part. The madness of passion is a cost best discovered in one's own time. But I will tell them. I will tell them that the deepest pain of the poet is not the receiving of visions that take one's breath away, nor the intensity of feelings that seem impossible for one body to bear, the challenge of being sensitive beyond comprehension or safety. No. The hardest part is learning that they will always fail. We always fail because our medium is imperfect. This is a losing battle. Poets are oars people using wooden sieves to scoop water out of leaking vessels, determined to reach a shore we cannot yet see as our ships sink beneath us, attempting to capture the ineffable beauty of life with a tool that is inherently flawed. The true madness of the poet is knowing we can never convey all that we feel. We can never quite get it right in this language made for conquering and counting sheep, for giving directions and maintaining war. So I will teach poets in training to run wildly in any direction as long as it takes them away from convention, pretension, and competition. To rip the armor off their hearts and the projections off their eyes, to follow beauty to its lair. I'll make them put on their walking shoes, be sure they're comfortable. Next to a smooth pen, a fine pair of walking shoes is a poet's best friend. And drag them out into the crisp autumn air. Have them describe the particular qualities of the afternoon sunlight in early November as it softly warms their red cheeks. I will hold them still to watch a single golden leaf make its final swirling wind dance from branch to earth.
I will tell them. Writing poetry, making any true art is like that. That leaf floating there. You must surrender to the currents of life. Let the winds have their way with you. You must know your task is impossible and that it will take your life as much as it gives you purpose. But all you can do is listen with your whole being. Work with the materials you have and enjoy the dance as you free fall.
That's great. Thank you. So you've spoken quite a bit about healing, and obviously you are a professional healer. And it seems clear to me that your art, your poetry, and your healing appear to be one thing. You know, there's no separation where some people might say, you know, this is my job and this is my art. So what would you say is the larger role of artists? Obviously, healing can be one role that artists play. What would you consider the larger role of art in the various endeavors of society?
I feel that artists are co-creators of the invisible architecture of a world that doesn't yet exist. I think of, you know, speculative fiction authors like Octavia Butler. I think of painters and inventors like Rembrandt or Leonardo da Vinci. I think of people who have tapped into their own imagination and the greater meta imagination of humanity and envisioned what was possible before they could actually see it, whether that be as personal and intimate as the possibility that they might experience love on the other side of grief or joy on the other side of great sorrow, all the way to humanity might experience a greater connection than we have now, that there might be a world on the other side of war. And that capacity to believe enough in the not yet visible potential of the future, believe enough in it to bring it into some kind of form that can be shared with someone else, that is both an authentic expression of the spirit of the artist as well as an offering to other people and to life. I feel like it's our duty, and it's part of why artists go a little crazy when we don't make art, because we have this compulsive energy moving through us, and it's, you know, what we offer to the world, part of our inspiration. And I understand healing as, you know, no one can do it for someone else. I cannot heal someone else, but I can hold a space of possibility where a person can discover their own healing potential. And it really depends on the person, how they're going to receive what they need. For some people, that's actual physical touch, and some people in some instances, that's words, or that's a visual art. I mean, we all have different inroads to our own healing capacity, and I feel like artists who have a intention, a lens towards healing, so much of what we offer is, yes, you can heal, you know, even holding that as a reality for the person or the people, like, yes, we can heal, that is possible, even if it seems impossible from inside of the perspective and the pain that you're in this moment. I see it as not guaranteed, but possible. And here is an inroad, here is a tool, here is a beautiful word, here is an inspiring word, here is a touch on this particular stuck muscle tissue, or whatever the tool is, the intention towards healing of an artist, I feel like enables us to think and experience and share and just live beyond what we can see in our momentary perspective of just what's happening, you know, right in front of our eyes.
This is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. My guest on Wider Window Poetry is Naima Lightseed. So I think we'd like to hear a couple more poems, and then I will end with a completely random question.
That sounds great. I have two pieces I'd love to end with. This next one is also one of my more recent ones, and it speaks to that question of, you know, what is the role of artists in the healing process, or how does art support healing from a more, I don't know if engaged is quite the word, but more obviously revolutionary way. I'll put it that way. It's called a prefigurative.
The future, not fixed, draws us forward as we reach towards it. Spider tickles my skin. We are weavers, both. I draw filaments of light braided with heartstrings, play our yearnings as a harp in a song not yet learned. Let the wind sing through me. Let the children sing to me. I am my mother's child. No thought will free mine of the legacy of slavery, only the careful unbinding of the dragon under my skin, whose volatile breath rips the pleasantries out of my mouth. The taste of ash gives courage. I will cry out until no more babes are harmed by the ones sworn to protect them, until no more sacred places crumble in hatred-born flames, until no one looks at my flesh and decides I am less for it. See my scales, weak men playing God. See my claws and shudder, recognize reckoning in serpentine gazes. This underbelly, once rent and rewoven, waits for those willing to bear their own, can only be seen by those who have also braved fire and trauma and learned the skill of grief, and that the hardest and most necessary thing to do is to find one's voice and sing. The future, not fixed, draws us forward as we reach towards it. We learn that tears are pickaxes breaking through the concrete over our hearts, wails the tethers that bring our soul pieces home, outraged howls the hammers that destroy that which wastes life, fists to the sky and voices speaking truth to power, the shovels of the great turning. This weaving is not done in a day or a lifetime and cannot be done alone. Uncertain yet inevitable, beauty. Beauty calls us on. Chaos and infinity, a maelstrom, a concordance, the paradox of birthing a tomorrow where we can see the sky. One part opening, envisioning our dancing grandchildren, creating through our believing. One part destroying, dismantling the structures that imprisoned our ancestors, healing through our unraveling. Seeds cannot grow in undigested poop. Learn to make compost again. Let me feel your hot breath. I will not mind too much if you brush me with your scales. I know they are there, beneath the patina of fragility and the weight of complacence. Don't tell me you have no time for the revolution, that it's not your job. We are too wily and too wild for such nonsense. I will only listen to your tenderness, be it whisper or roar, and the truth that calls you on.
And the last one that I'll share is also one of my older ones. And it's another piece that, like many of these I share today, kind of sums up my perspective on life, on healing, on art, on so many aspects of our life these days. And it's called Map.
Following the clues on this modern day quest, a new way of putting our faith to the test. Following my heart to find a part in this epic play of life reset. And it's not quite like back in the day, no apparent dragon in need of a good slay. It's time we lay our notions aside. The lie? An economy built on slavery. The journey? To set each other and ourselves free. I have learned to recognize that it starts with me. I can't just walk on concrete to reach the mountain cave. I have learned that dragons are my allies. And all my friends are witches. Rainbows rarely end on flat ground or start without a storm. So I climb, swim, fly to reach my pot of gold, which is not just green, and once found, can never be sold. Following the clues on this modern day quest is a new way of listening, a different kind of treasured chest awaiting. The map is not tattered yellow paper, but a specter of sacred geometry or a diagram of our diaphragms. How to breathe through our bodies, how to heal with our hands. The little birdie still tells us where to go, how to flow, but now they're 5'4" in platform boots and day-glow fur, and the guardian of the threshold is checking IDs, and the dragons we can see are painted on our tapestries or tattooed on our bodies. But still, we are in the magic land, and we must know when to wield our swords, when to sweep ourselves, when to humble ourselves in the holy places. We must understand the measure. We are the treasure we seek. We are the treasure we seek. If we are ever going to find it, ask why it was hidden in the first place. This race with a new pace can only lead us away from or back to home. And our folly, as we hide from or chase what could only ever be inside us. Following. It's the quest that defines.
Thank you, Naima. Now here's the random question. If you could visit one event in history, not to change it, but just to observe it, what would you choose and why?
Well, the one that pops in, and this is, you know, provided no one would see me, is when Harriet Tubman led a mission to, I want to say it was Combahee River, after she had escaped herself and at that point already come back and run multiple missions in the Underground Railroad and freed several, I think, I want to say hundreds of people, and was willing to keep returning because she believed not only in her own freedom, but in the freedom of her people, and not as some concept, but as the true experience that was going to happen. And I think this speaks to my answer earlier about artists as visionaries of what might be possible, that she held with such conviction that her people were free, that she was willing to return to the war zone to be a part of literally setting more people free. And she, you know, arrived in the boats of the Union Army, and because she had been able to be in conversation with some of the people who were still in plantation, they did, you know, burn down several of the plantation houses, set free several hundreds of people on that one day. And just that combination of visionary, you know, belief in a truth beyond what seemed to be evident in the moment, and willingness to do what was needed to actually bring that vision into fruition.
Thank you. You've been listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Naima Lightseed was my guest this month, and as always, stay safe, be careful, and we'll see you again next month. Thank you for listening.
This body. This body. This body. This body. This body. This body of knowledge. This body of wisdom. Self-bright prism made of everything we have ever loved. Mystery encoded in flesh and bone, bound like bread into the great baker's oven, stewed in the alchemist's brew, made of me, made of you, going back to the first mother. Every cell holding the key to its own freedom, unlocked by the body's own wisdom. The song of my grandmother's 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 people, lost to mind in the hulls of ships and the cracks of whips. The magic of our sacred blood, lost in spun cotton and cheap tranquilizers. The knowingness of our intrinsic interconnectedness, lost to missionary's book and soldier's blade. All remembered. Always known. In the bodies we finally call home. I call this body home. I ask in the language beyond words for the truth beyond wounds. The rewoven stories and unwinding muscles all offer the same benediction. We have always been holy. Holy, 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 holy. Always been home. We need only listen to our bodies of wisdom.
Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulé.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.